Our next case for argument this morning is Mote v. Aetna Life Insurance Company. Mr. Dubofsky.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel. When the evidence of Brenda Mote's disabling pain and depression due to fibromyalgia and migraine headaches is looked at through the lens of this Court's guiding precedents in Hawkins v. First Union, Hackett v. Xerox, and Ladd v. ITT, Aetna's decision must be found arbitrary and capricious. The Court should examine the final denial letter issued by Aetna, which in and of itself reveals how arbitrary and capricious the decision was. At page 2 of that letter, which is in the record at page 6, Aetna says, although your subjective musculoskeletal symptoms are credible, they are not accounted for by identifiable neurological or musculoskeletal pathology. That is exactly what this Court said in Hawkins v. First Union is not a credible basis for determination in a fibromyalgia case. In Hawkins, this Court repeated what it had stated earlier in Sarche v. Chater and said that fibromyalgia has no laboratory tests. That in fibromyalgia cases, this is precisely what you would find, that there would be no identifiable neurological or musculoskeletal pathology. The decision goes on to state that the limitations and restrictions of Dr. West and Dr. Gruft are not supported, especially since the majority of the tests found no significant diseases or abnormal findings according to our medical review. Again, this repeats the same mistake as the defendant made in Hawkins.
So you're essentially arguing that their position is fibromyalgia isn't a disorder?
Exactly.
Since it's characterized by this lack of the so-called objective indicia?
Even though for 5 years Aetna said, Ms. Mote, you are disabled by fibromyalgia, we accept your proofs, we accept your treating physician's reports. They had asked the treating physicians to provide specific guidelines that relate precisely to fibromyalgia. They accepted those findings.
But, you know, I guess that argument that you made didn't do too much for me, in that it seems to me Aetna should be entitled, if arguably they made a mistake, you know, 5 years ago, to correct that mistake at some point. So the fact that they'd been giving her benefits in and of itself doesn't strike me as too much. The fact that fibromyalgia or depression, for that matter, which she doesn't seem to be making anything of, are disorders, even though you can't, you know, do an MRI scan on her or whatever and say, aha, you know, that now we know, that's a different point. And our decisions, as you say, have made it clear that these somewhat more difficult to diagnose and less inclined to leave traces sorts of diseases might suffice.
Except that Aetna never said that they had made a mistake. And Aetna repeated, even in this final denial, that they considered the pain complaints to be credible. Yet their final conclusion is your daily living activities, such as taking your mother to the doctor's office, going to the bank, etc., appear out of proportion to your complaints of pain, of limitations and restrictions.
Now, that takes you to the surveillance tapes. And I guess there, given that this is arbitrary and capricious review, they do see her doing, at least on those 2 days, they see her doing things that seem inconsistent with her complaints. Maybe on many other days they don't, but...
Well, again, Hawkins addressed that. Hawkins talked about the activities that Mr. Hawkins was engaging in and said that the alternative is becoming completely inert and that people are going to make an effort to exceed their limitations. But it goes even beyond that. What this case really boils down to is at the end of the road, Aetna sent the records to Dr. Hall for review. And they said, Dr. Hall, we want you to weigh all of this evidence and give us your opinion. And Dr. Hall says, I've weighed all this evidence, and my opinion is that the weight of medical credibility is with the treating doctors and that Ms. Mote is incapable of performing sustained work activity unless I see something else.
Right, and then he looks at the surveillance tapes,
right.
the excerpts of
he
the
gets
surveillance.
Excerpts of 2 days of surveillance, totally ignoring the 14 other days, which show virtually no activity whatsoever.
Now, I take it those tapes are not in the record. Is that correct, or are they?
I had actually tried to check that yesterday, and the record had been checked out to Chambers.
Yeah,
but
I think they are not in the record, unfortunately.
I believe that that's correct. But even putting that aside, the 2 days that Dr. Hall looked at, one of those days showed nothing but Ms. Mote going to her mailbox and retrieving her mail and picking up a newspaper from the driveway, hardly an indicator that she could work on a consistent basis. And the other day she takes her mother to the doctor and goes out for a meal afterward. Again, hardly an indicator that somebody is capable of working on a consistent basis. And the evidence to believe that Dr. Hall would suddenly change his opinion based on such flimsy evidence seems to be no more than what this court said in Hawkins, that it's just scraps offsetting the evidence that was presented. Dr. Gruft and Dr. West wrote report after report after report detailing their clinical findings, detailing Ms. Mote's need to take narcotic pain medication, and stating repeatedly that she was not getting better. In fact, Dr. West indicated that she had retrogressed at the time that the benefits were terminated. So in light of all of this evidence, when Dr. Hall made the conclusion, the weight of medical credibility sides with these treating doctors, that's a reasonable conclusion. For Aetna to shove a couple of snippets of surveillance video in front of him and have him make a sudden change of opinion seems incredible and seems to be very much like the situation that we pointed out in our briefs was present in McDonald versus Western Southern in front of the Sixth Circuit, where the doctor writes a very favorable report and gets taken out to the woodshed, and all of a sudden he writes a utterly different report in which he gives completely different opinions.
I wonder if you could just take a minute to address Aetna's status as a defendant versus the plan. You named the plan also, so
right.
I wonder what difference it makes and why you think the administrator of the plan, functionally Aetna, why they need to be in here.
I think they do need to be in here because they're the actual party. The district court made a fundamental mistake in writing that Aetna was the agent of the plan. Aetna was not the agent of the plan.
Well, didn't Aetna write a policy? I mean, the plan had an obligation under its terms to do things, and they took out a policy with Aetna, right, that implements that obligation.
Correct.
So doesn't that make Aetna their agent?
Aetna was the underwriter.
Yeah.
Aetna was the insurer. Aetna made the initial claim decision. Aetna made the ongoing claim decision. Aetna made the final decision, and Aetna paid the benefits. Aetna was acting completely independently of the plan, particularly now that we know that Arthur Anderson is no longer in existence.
We do know that. No, but Aetna's do that. You could be describing any agent, you know, as long as they're acting within the scope of their authority, right? And there's no question that Aetna's acting outside the scope of the authority the plan gave to it, right?
There's no other plan. There's just an insurance policy that we're dealing with in this case. You know, this court is familiar with situations such as the Hawkins case where there actually was a plan.
No other plan.
There is no other plan in the record, Your Honor. The only thing that can be labeled a plan is the policy.
Are you saying that the plan has been dissolved? Or just that you haven't sued it and therefore there's nothing in the record?
No, you've sued it, but I thought you were saying there wasn't a document called that had typed across the top of the page the Arthur Anderson long-term disability plan. But
precisely.
I thought there was such a document.
An entity.
But
it looked to me like you had sued it, and then you say there doesn't exist, and I'm now totally plumbed.
I sued it because this circuit's case law says that I have
does
to.
Does it exist?
I don't believe so.
Do you serve process on it? Did it accept the service?
We serve process on Aetna, and Aetna accepted service.
Process on the plan?
Not that I'm aware of. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Philip Holloway. I represent Aetna Life Insurance Company and the Arthur Anderson LLP Group Long-Term Disability Insurance Plan, which, if
Does it exist?
Actually, Your Honor, we've had this issue, I believe, arose in a separate case with Mr. Dabowski's firm, and we have not in this case, yes, Your Honor, it does exist as the policy.
What?
What? A policy differs from an entity.
When Arthur Anderson was wrapped up.
Who is he insured under this policy?
Arthur Anderson. It's employees and it's partners.
Directly, or is this a policy that the plan... I mean, usually, if there's an ERISA plan, there's a thing called the plan.
Yeah.
It's an entity. It's a legal entity.
It
they might
be.
Take
you
out
know,
a policy
it has
with...
boards of trustees. That this is elaborately spelled out in ERISA. It has governing bodies. It has people who can promulgate changes. And these things survive the demise of the employer. At least they're supposed to.
I have to say, Your Honor, that's an issue that we did not address... And obviously, we didn't address it in our brief. And throughout the litigation of this issue, we considered it to be an issue that wasn't dispositive of the actual long-term disability determination.
Well, I will say in this question whether Aetna is a proper party to the case, I think this is quite a different situation from the cases where people try to sue employers in lieu of or in addition to plans here, because the employer is not the agent of the plan in the same way that Aetna is functioning, assuming there's a plan there, which I guess we don't know. Maybe the parties could help us out here. Aetna has been functioning as its agent, it seems to me, and I'm not sure why you can't sue an agent plus a principal at the same time. I think the district court might have been a little hasty about that, but you're confusing me tremendously by not knowing whether you stood up and said you're representing the plan, but I guess you haven't talked to anybody who is part of the plan entity lately.
In practice, Your Honor, we dealt with the insurer, with frankly the folks at Aetna.
Okay. Is there any document indicating that Aetna has succeeded to whatever obligations the plan had?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
And what does the insurance policy say? Does it say that, does it run directly to the Arthur Anderson employees, or does it run to the plan?
With respect to...
Well, there's a thing that Aetna's apparently been using to pay money out, at least to somebody, unless it's a total sham. So when Aetna evaluates claims and hires doctors to do functional evaluations and decides, you know, you get long-term benefits, you don't, they're doing that through some document, right? There's a policy, and I thought the policy was in the record.
It was my understanding that it is.
Right. And so I haven't looked at it lately. I thought maybe you might know whether the beneficiary of that policy is listed as the employees of Arthur Anderson somehow, or is it listed as the Arthur Anderson long-term disability plan?
As the beneficiary?
Mm-hmm.
I'm unaware of that at this time, Your Honor. I haven't looked at the actual plan documents.
Okay.
Prior to preparation for this.
Well, let me ask you a substantive question, which I'm sure you are ready to discuss. I'm quite troubled by the use of these surveillance tapes, which do seem to be central to this case, because it seems to me, unless somebody were to view all of the tapes in their entirety, you could create very misleading snippets of you know, here's 5 minutes, you know, where she's driving down the street, or here's 30 minutes, you know, while she's eating lunch with her mother, two different days, when all of the rest of the time shows this woman barely able to walk from her front doorstep down to her mailbox. Surely giving the evaluating doctor only bits and pieces is not a valid way to handle things.
Your Honor, I would say that from the inception of Ms. Moat's claim, her doctors consistently said she was incapable of even the most minimal sedentary activity.
But remember, now, the record also says that she had tended to overextend herself before she went on long-term disability. And as I recall, one of the times that they saw her driving, she was actually driving to the mandatory FCE that Aetna was insisting she go to.
Correct.
So that seems a little harsh to criticize her for that.
But let's take a look at another two-week window, Your Honor, that I believe it encompasses both of those January 29th and February 4th, 2003 surveillance tapes. Beginning January 22nd, Dr. Gruff submits an APS that says, my client can do nothing. She is inert. She's incapable of the most minimum sedentary activity.
And
she
by
cannot
that, what
bend.
Does he mean? Like pain? I mean, people can do things even if they're in pain. Does it mean that she can sit at work from 9 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon, 5 days a week? Probably
not. The surveillance itself?
Yeah, the surveillance doesn't indicate that.
Well, Your Honor, the surveillance is only one piece of the evidence that the plan used to or utilized to determine that Ms. Moat was no longer disabled.
It's a piece, but it's a piece that it uses, I think, in an incomplete way, I'll say.
Well, Your Honor, like I said, if you take a look at in January 22nd, Dr. Gruff does submit the APS. Less than a week later, Ms. Moat is seen taking her mother to a planned doctor's appointment.
Right.
Now, if the plan were to take Ms. Moat's testimony or her indication that she was incapable of even the most minimal sedentary activity unless they were other than the 10% that she had good days, quote-unquote good days, she was able to, less than 7 days after Dr. Gruff submitted the APS, to engage in a six-hour full activity for 6 hours, showing no indication that she had any restrictions whatsoever.
No, well, you've blown that up into something. She drives her mother to the appointment. She probably sits then. I don't know if you've been to a doctor's office lately, but it involves a lot of sitting time for many of us. And then she drives her mother back. To go from she can do a little more than the doctor said all the way to she's not disabled, I'm not sure is a logical step to take.
When viewed in light of the fact that she's her only job descriptions were sedentary, which is the most minimal amount of effort, the plan believes that it is, with all due respect, a logical step to take.
You've also assumed that she doesn't have, that she's not really disabled because fibromyalgia doesn't show up on X-rays or MRIs or blood tests or other kinds of objective indicia, and it certainly does not. It's not that kind of disease.
That is correct. That is one part of the consideration.
And so why does Aetna have a policy of assuming that people aren't really sick unless you can look at it on an X-ray?
I don't believe that is the policy, Your Honor. They did credit her with being disabled under her own occupation for 3.5 or 5 years, actually.
But you've just said there's no difference between her own occupation and any occupation, since her own occupation was totally sedentary. What could be less than her own occupation was? And indeed, some of the jobs that you listed that you thought she might be able to do were her own occupation.
I admit there is no bright line between ONOC and sedentary occupation,
you know,
in this consideration. But
for a lot of people, of course, there would be. It's perfectly reasonable to have that language in the policy. But in her case, as applied, there's no difference. Unless you can give me an example of something that's even less demanding than sitting all day long.
Well, as I stand here, I would say that there are other jobs that, given her descriptions of her pain and her limitations, that she may be able to do that don't require her to sit for 8 hours a day. A bank teller, my job does not require me to sit for 8 hours a day. I sit at my desk a lot, but I do get up and move around. There are differences within the category of sedentary jobs that Ms. Moat could do, or that the plan determined that she could do.
I don't know where it is in your brief, but it seemed, as I recall, there was a recitation of her job description that I assume was put in there to show that there are a lot of variations and lots of assignments to move here and go there. I don't remember where that is, but isn't that correct?
That is correct, sir. I mean, Your Honor, that is in the statement of facts where we describe her job. I believe it says that she sat 75% of the time, that she had to do various manipulations with her fingers for 20% of the time, use a computer.
Sitting,
I'm sorry,
while she's sitting, I guess.
Yes.
I guess there's a distinction at 5 years that frankly, looked like they kind of ignored her. as far as your client is concerned. Just, you know, and then 5 years, there's sort of a, I don't know what, a red flag goes up and say, no, we better check her out because that time is up. And then they put a different standard on it. Is that what happened?
That's, yes, Your Honor, that's a fair characterization. My time is up, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Dabowski? Thank you very much.